This Dharma talk was recorded live at the Austin Zen Center in Austin, Texas. If you enjoy these talks and wish to support the temple and its offerings, please visit austinzencenter.org. Thank you for listening.
I want to say three things to the people who are just beginning before I, well, this is the beginning of my talk, so. The three things are that you must, three skills that you must develop. And these three skills not only will serve you well in the beginning, but basically throughout. There's nothing for you to do except develop these three skills in the beginning. The first one is find a way to be present. And if I may say, all the time. Okay, so whenever your mind is going to go away somewhere, bring it back to the body over and over again, 100,000 times, enough so that it is habitually present. That's what you want. A mind that is habitually present, that serves you instead of the other way around. Go to retreats, do long sits, do what, put you know, on your computer, if you use a computer, assign breathe or return or whatever to get yourself in the present moment. The other night, we did service. I was here for service, and a person handed me the service chant card. And there was a person in front of me to the right that I knew I needed to hand a card to. And so because my mind did that, I wasn't fully there to receive the card. And this person handed it to me with two hands. She made an effort. And I wasn't there to receive her effort. And I felt badly, because it's my practice to be present all the time. You have to get that under your belt, okay? The second thing is you need to develop some kind of practice that when you do come back to the body, that's what you're coming back to, right? When you do come back, that you learn a way to be able to be present with your own emotions. So the practice that I usually teach is called RAIN, but you can do it in any way you want to. So RAIN means recognize, basically be present, recognize what's happening, accept or acknowledge or allow. In other words, don't resist and don't keep it going with a mind story. Only the body, recognize what's there, allow it to be there because it's there actually already, and you are recognizing that that happened. You're angry or whatever, your heart's beating. The third thing is investigate the sensations in the body that just recall some kind of emotion. Anger is so easy to talk about because so many people are very angry. I used to have an anger thing, so I'm not afraid of anger. I'm not afraid of that energy. You can do good things with that energy, but you do need to be able to feel it fully and allow it to pass through without being reactive. These are things you already know. So I'm just confirming what you know is correct. So investigate the sensations in the body. Go to the body, feel what's happening. N, no identification. It's just a passing event. Now, if you suppress it, or if you do a train, you know, a thought train with whatever made you angry that you're so sure about, that will keep it going. And people can keep that kind of thing going for decades. I'm laughing, but it's not funny. It's actually sad. R-A-I. Oh, no identification. Do not say, I mean, you can if you want to. Try not to say, I am angry. Just say, you know, there's an anger event passing through, just like, unfortunately, these clouds. I do like matcha. Thank you. All right, so that's rain. So be present, do some kind of physical, get to the body. The body is actually what will transform in this practice. The transformation happens through the body, not the mind. It's a body practice. Zen is a body practice. Buddhism is a body practice. Then no identification. Oh, I said that already. Okay, that's enough of that. The third one is do some kind of a compassion practice, because most of the people who start doing Buddhism in the West, we have a thing, you know, about self-hatred. It's so sad, but we do. And so, you know, develop some kind of compassion practice, either Tonglen or Metta. They both work. Begin to soften around the mind chatter that is self rude, very rude. All right, that's the beginning. So I got that out of the way. You must do that. Those skills are necessary if you want to walk on this path, which is not easy, but it works. So walk on it with other people. It's very good. When I used to come here, sort of regularly, a long time ago, one time I did a month-long retreat at Tenzo. Remember Tenzo? Month-long retreat on Vasubandhu. Vasubandhu is a famous in our lineage, famous fellow who wrote something called the 30 Verses about, my mind is so funny. I'm not gonna edit, so whatever comes up there, I'll tell you what happened. Where was I? 30 Verses. Thank you. So the 30 verses are wonderful. The first 15 of them explain how we get into trouble. Why do we cause ourselves suffering? How does that happen? How does the mind transform itself into what we are familiar with up there? And the rest of it, 16 through 30, explain how to be free of that. So I like this teaching. It's a really wonderful teaching. It's a little bit obscure when you actually read the 30 verses. So I'm going to tell you the end. So the bottom line mostly is, I mean, it is fascinating to study. If you're really serious about this, you'll have to do studying along the way, because all of these studies are pointers to your own freedom and freedom of everyone. But the bottom line basically is, don't reify thought. I'm pausing because, you know, inside I bet you're saying, right, don't reify thought. Sure, I can do that. Easy. Easy, easy. No, it's not. It's not. The reason he suggested is because when we have a thought of any kind and we hold on to it, it begins to create, ultimately, it creates a me, which we experience as a separate, unchanging entity from which we grasp after whatever we think will make us happy or not suffer or whatever it is. And we push away and hate even. There's an aversion. We try to push away things that are going to make us, we think, unhappy or whatever. So there's a koan that I like. Let me see if I can remember it. Oh, here it has to start. Oh, yeah. Okay. Somebody is leaving a monastery, and the teacher asks the person, "Where are you going?" And the person says, "I'm going on pilgrimage." And the teacher says, What's pilgrimage about? Where are you going?" And the student says, "I don't know." And the teacher says, "Not knowing is nearest." Sometimes it's interpreted, "Not knowing is most intimate." So in two ways, if we think about it as not knowing is most intimate, that means us now. I don't know you. And therefore, I can be perfectly open and intimate. I should have done that with the person who handed me the card. I had an idea. I need to give the card to that person. That idea got in the way. There is no intimacy if we are projecting onto everybody else who we think they are, what we think is happening. Intimacy develops with an open heart and mind. Most intimate, not knowing. And then there's another not knowing that's nearest. It's a taste. It's a taste. Not knowing, standing and not knowing, having a mind that's, "Oh, there's another koan." No, there's not a koan. It's a story about a student came to a teacher. And he was telling the teacher about Vasubandhu and how much he knew about Vasubandhu. And how Vasubandhu should be taught here or done that or whatever. And the teacher is pouring a cup of tea and keeps pouring and keeps pouring and keeps pouring. And it begins to overflow the cup. And the fellow says, "What are you doing?" And the teacher said, "With a mind that already knows everything, there is no place for anything else to be learned, to be open to." That's why not knowing is nearest, because in a place of not knowing, we are open to the mystery. It is a mystery that we're here and alive at all. The mystery. I want to read you a poem about not knowing before I talk about mystery. This is a poem written by Laura, who used to live here. She's now a teacher at the Brooklyn Zen Center. And I'm going to transmit to her as a layperson, full transmission as a layperson. I do that because I think it's a way, an appropriate response to what is actually happening with Buddhism in the United States. Most people are lay practitioners, and lay practitioners need to know that there is a path, a full path, that can be recognized and walked as a non-resident. So we have a small group, four people, and we were talking about one of the koan. Oh, this koan, actually, this koan about not knowing. And we asked them to write a poem, and this was her poem. I should say something about Laura. I asked her if I could read the poem. She said, okay, so I'm gonna tell you a little bit. She has had a little niggly thing about doubt, about her own confidence in teaching in Buddhism and so on. So this is coming from that place in her, although she's a mature teacher now. So you can see in the poem how she handles that. It's kind of beautiful. How I want to know, not just to know, but to be wise, utterly wise. The little one still searching for solid ground where she can always feel safe, certain, strong, thinking that knowing will grow her feet long and wide enough to fill these ancestral shoes. Looking down at her bare, run-of-the-mill toes, she hears the voices of her elders that are now also hers. Treasure the nakedness, the smallness. Treasure also the wish to know, and just keep walking the path, and I will keep walking beside you. This is a mature person. Beautiful poem. So this not knowing place, this open place to the mystery, this pregnant mystery, we can approach by asking ourselves the question, what am I? What am I really? Few weeks ago, almost a month ago now, I think, there was a young woman, some of you know her, her name still is Carolyn. She was a sweet, dear, kind, artistic, thoughtful, lovely person. And she took a walk, a very common walk, a walk that I've walked dozens of times in the wilderness right around Tassajara. It's called a horse pasture trail. It had been raining a lot. And the waterfall that she was trying to walk over was wider and too slippery. And she slipped and fell down the waterfall and died. And, you know, when a young person dies, it's hard to fathom. It's not supposed to happen, you know. So I want to talk a little bit about death in two ways. In one way, when we lose someone we care about deeply, we grieve. It's the body that does the grieving, not here. The body is what grieves and will tears will rise. Sometimes in the middle of a, you know, conversation or having dinner or just walking down the street, that's the body's way of healing itself. Because when we lose someone, we're really close with that part of ourselves too, that was in that relationship is also no longer there. And we grieve that. And we do ritual. And we come together. Help each other. And there's another way of thinking about death also. I remember when my own mother died many, many, many years ago, too young also. And she died in the hospital and her body was, my brother laid out her, my brother is a very interesting person. I love my brother. He did a fabulous job. You know, he put flowers and flower petals all around her and everything that, needed to be done, he did. It was beautiful. And we each had a turn to go into the room where she was alone and say goodbye. So I went in and I stood over her and I didn't understand what was happening. And so I bent down really low and I put my hand on her chest and I was listening. I was trying to feel if she was breathing. What happens at death? What is left? What goes? The same mystery happens at birth. Same thing. Is it the breath? Is it a soul? You know, we say these things to try to explain, but you can't grasp it. You can't get it because it's a mystery. Life is a mystery. That we take for granted. Birth and death. Birthing and deathing. Birth, death. birth and death. Birth and death are not different. Birth and death are what life does. And even more, as human beings, we're aware of that. That awareness alone, that is Buddha mind, that knowing quality is Buddha mind. We all are life. We all are this Buddha mind already. Everything is a gigantic, dependently arisen, changing, interpenetrating, interrelational something. What is it? There's another koan that I like lately. It's my favorite koan lately. It's about dependently arising. Everything. A monk and a teacher are walking along, and the monk looks up and some bird is passing by, and the monk says, "What's that?" And the teacher says, "It's a wild goose." Here it would be a grackle. "It's a wild goose." And the student says, "Where does it come from?" And the teacher says, "Where indeed? It comes from everything. We, each of us, are a miracle. And as we don't hold on to thought, as we don't reify thought, we also especially don't reify thoughts that create a me, a separate, solid entity. We're really careful about those kind of thoughts. Every single one of them. And slowly we become transparent. There's less and less meing happening. And we make a shift, at first quite subtle, from relating from a place of separation, shift. Oh, here's another koan. This is this shift for Tozan. He's walking across he leaves his, there's another great koan about him leaving his teacher, which I have now forgotten. And he goes and he crosses a stream and he looks down and he sees himself reflected in the water. And he says something like, I'm not going to remember it, but the punchline is, you are not it. It actually is. You are not it. It actually is you. This is that shift. I'm not going forward as an individual, independent something. No, the shift is what we are is life doing itself out through this unique conglomeration of stuff for a moment. And then I turn into something else. Or it turns into something else. Better way of putting it. I bought, that's interesting. I was going to say I bought a ticket to death. No. I bought, what I bought was a I paid this company to take my body when I die. And what they do is, I don't mean to be disrespectful, but what they do is they make the body, this particular one, they will make it into compost. I'm so happy. They're going to take the compost and they put it right now. They are something. There's a word there that's appropriate that I have to remember. A forest.
Rewilding.
Rewilding or regrowing, remake it. It was denuded, you know, from logging in Washington State. So they are spreading. It's kind of funny to talk about this way, but they're spreading people around as compost under a tree, which is exactly what I wanted. So I found this company. And let's see, where was I on my talk? Oh. So we are this totally interconnected, interpenetrated event. As much as we are an independent, unique iteration of life, we're both. And our practice moves us from being mostly and coming from a place of me wanting, pushing away, and so on, to this shift. And anger mostly drops away. And grasping pretty much drops away. Because those two things come from this delusion that we're separate. Oh, I think I'm almost done. Is that right?
You can speak as long as you like.
Well, I want to hear from you questions, because I want to meet you there. So I want to say one more thing that's, I think, kind of important. This understanding of no separation, of the unity of everything, has to be the way we walk in the world. Especially now. And this is, I believe, right now, the great gift of Buddhism, this teaching. Because you can see in the news greed, hate, delusion. And we cannot walk in the world that is not aligned with truth. That's our job, to embody that. Our job always to embody whatever insight we have. That's what keeps us going. Everything has to be embodied. So if we understand this teaching of wholeness, we can't do words. I create division, not in the Sangha, and not as a person responding to the news. We have to be really careful, because it's so easy to get carried away with hate, with projecting onto people. Now more than ever, be careful. So, I have feelings. You know, we create as people, all of us are creating a mess. In every way. It starts with you as an individual, not creating division, not in yourself first, address that first. You know, when you fight with yourself, you know, when you're talking to yourself, I'm whatever your nasty little mind is saying, right? And then all the thoughts that create me, first address it, the war that's inside. And then we have to find a better way to be with each other. Otherwise, human beings are not going to make it, which might not be so bad for everybody else, you know? But anyway, we do the best we can. I believe everybody is doing the best they can, always. So, but make the best effort. Don't create division with speech. I'm looking at two lovely flower arrangements, which is really interesting. You know, it's painful for me to think about where we are as human beings and how we walk in the world. There's so much suffering. So instead of staying there, I looked at the flowers. I don't want to end this, our gathering together, with such a sadness. So I looked up at the flowers to make it better for us. Okay, that's my talk. If you have questions, I will respond for a while or whatever.
So, Maura is Greg's partner.
Laura.
Yeah, that's right. So if you could tell her that I say hi and that she made a big impression or helped me with stuff. I'm Sherry.
Could you leave me a note about that?
Yes.
Thank you.
But I just want to say, we were sharing one time, a long time ago, in the Zendo, and we were talking about what we tell ourselves about ourselves. And you're so right that we can be so rude to ourselves but so kind to others. It's just a paradox. But so I was going upstairs after this encounter, and she stopped me. She ran after me, and she told me that she didn't think of me that way. And she shared with me things that, you know, it really helped me overcome the way I talk.
I will definitely tell her.
Yeah.
Please do write me a note. Make sure I have it.
Okay. Good.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. Yes.
Tina, many, many years ago, you were here and you said something that really kind of changed the total way I look at things. I went into focus on with you, and you said, did you know that you always do the best you can? And at first I didn't understand, and I thought, well, wait a minute, how does she know? And then I realized what you were really saying, and I've always been so grateful to you for that teaching, and it really changed the way I looked at things.
I am, by the way, I'm going to be here another number of days. I leave on the 13th. So if you would like to have Doka-san, I'd be very happy to do that. I'm very happy to meet people and support whoever feels I can do that with them.
I think we have a question from someone on Zoom. Annie, would you like to speak your question, or you can type it? You can Annie will type it. She says 1 minute. Okay, if someone else wants to go, then we can circle back to her.
Yes.
Thank you for your talk. I was wondering if you could share the three tips for people starting out Buddhism again.
Be present. Try to be present all the time. Come back all day long. Do a practice that has you coming back to the body to take care of emotional events. And do a compassion practice for yourself. Gentleness toward yourself.
So, I'm going to be honest about my own experience of not always feeling that people are doing the best that they can, mm-hmm. especially given the state of the world. Mm-hmm. And there's a space where sometimes I make a choice and I know I'm not doing the best I can, uh-huh. you know? So I imagine that others are making that choice. And that we're in this mess in part because of those collective choices. So how can we be doing the best we can?
Good. I'm glad you asked. So when we see only from a place of meaning, I'm going to give you category teaching. This is such a great teaching. I think it'll help. When we live in the world of relativity, of me and other, of concepts. This is what words make division. That's what they do. And they're useful, right? But they create a delusion. But if you live in that world, you're totally responsible for everything that you do, completely. And so in that world, they're not doing the best they can. They make other choices, right? But in the world of dependent arising, the koan about the wild goose, where indeed did it come from? Where indeed did that behavior come from? It didn't come from that person only. It came from the whole thing. And in that way, everyone is forgiven everything. It's not them. It's the whole cosmos that was making that stupid karma. Decision.
Right? Is it the ancient twisted karma?
Yeah, it's the ancient, that's right. So it's very helpful for us to understand ourselves in both ways. It can begin to help us be compassionate toward ourselves and forgive ourselves. And also both. Try to do the best you can. Right? Both are always true. Both.
I just want to say thank you for your Dharma talk. It was marvelous. And if you wanted to comment on the embodiment aspect of it. One time years ago, I asked my teacher, when does this conclude, this practice? And is there a get there? Do I get there? You know, kind of thing. And he said, it will always be this way. So thoughts coming in, our releasing them, the embodiment process. And we change as a result, as you said. But what you said really reminded me of that, and it's a precious practice, you know, a knowledge that over time, that embodiment goes deeper and deeper and wider and never ends in its capacity to change us and release us from our strictures. And so. Anyway, I just wanted to thank you for that because it reminded me of that. It was such a precious reminder. Thank you. Thank you.
Welcome. Annie is ready to ask a question on Zoom. Annie, you can unmute yourself. Oh, okay. Can you speak to the student-teacher relationship and why it is central to Zen practice?
Yeah, especially Zen. There is a need for an intimate relationship with the teacher because we don't, especially in Soto Zen, we don't tell you much of what to do. In fact, my even saying there are three things that you need to establish originally. When I first started in Zen, and actually for years and years and years and years, only recently has changed, I wasn't told anything. And the reason is, pretty good reason, because, you know, Soto Zen was a monastic practice. So you were with people and teachers all the time. You would see the teacher behave. You were, you know, talking to the teacher, depending on whether it was Rinzai or Soto, you know, many times. And the teacher can see your behavior and so on and so forth. But here, we are not in that container. And so we have to establish a relationship with the teacher to have someone who's guiding us and giving us feedback and supporting us. It's necessary in Zen. And sometimes you'll have trouble, you know, with the teacher because oftentimes they don't see things the way you do, or they see things you don't want them to see. And not everybody, but a lot of the people, me too, I had trouble with one of my teachers. Yeah, but that's okay. That's okay, you just stick with it, keep going. It's important to have a teacher. It's equally important to have a sangha. The three of them, the teacher, say, the sangha, and the teaching. All important. Was that enough, Annie?
She wants you to know that it's Annie from Scotland, by the way.
Oh, okay. Hello, anything else?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you also for your talk. And I've been thinking a lot about anger. I have a lot of anger about the world and what we're doing to each other. And I sometimes don't know what to do with it. And I was thinking about the divisive speech you're talking about. And also thinking about how sometimes anger has actually fueled movements for mm-hmm. justice. And mm-hmm. so one of the things I just keep wrestling with is like, is there a space or a role for like righteous anger in Buddhism and in Zen? And so mm-hmm. do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do. Them? Yeah. I have some more. Thank you. What I see happening with social movements lately is a kind of self-righteousness that is destructive. So it's okay if anger builds energy for you to get out there and do things, but if you hold on to the thoughts that create that anger, your behavior will be as destructive as what you're trying to address. And my experience is that with people who are in that work, even from social workers to political vote, get out the vote people and so on, which is fabulous. I mean, I'm not saying no, definitely. But the way we do things, what I was going to say is, they don't know how to let go. We have to do the best we can and then let go and not expect that our effort is going to result in anything. The reason I'm stopping is because one time I was at, I don't know if this is a good example, but came to mind. I was at a month long at Spirit Rock, and my job was to clean the bathroom, which was great because I could do it at my own time. So it was perfect. Two bathrooms, bottom, first floor, second floor bathroom. And I did that for 30 days, happily. And then at the end, when I was going to leave, I was supposed to clean the bathroom before I left. Thank you so much. And I went into the bathroom and I didn't want to. I had done it for 30 days, both bathrooms, and a pretty good job myself, I might say. And I just didn't want to. I was tired and I was almost gone anyway. And so why? It was clean enough. I mean, after all, I'd been cleaning it. You know, what was there to clean anyway? And then all of a sudden, I saw a smudge on the mirror. And I thought, oh, I'll just do the smudge. And I wiped away the smudge and I turned around and there were prints on the, you know, faucet. And so I cleaned, you know, it was right next door. So I cleaned the faucet prints. And then I looked in there, et cetera, et cetera. I had no idea I was cleaning the bathroom. I was only doing the next thing that needed to be done. And at the end, the bathroom was clean. You do the best you can, and then you let go. Because if you have some idea about how things should be, and you enforce that, even if you think you're righteous, look what, Tia, calm down. Look what's happening in the Middle East. You don't think I have feelings about it? I'm Jewish. Of course I do have feelings about it. And my biggest practice is to not make division. Israel and the Palestine people both have absolutely righteous points of view, without question. And both of them are horrible right now. Both. So if we only see from one side, if we only think that our way of seeing is the only thing that is going to take care of the world, we're deluded. So we do the best we can. If people are, you know, working for a ceasefire, go right ahead and do that. But don't do it with hate, because it will not solve anything.
Can I interject? So a couple of weeks ago, a month ago, can't remember, we had a two-period sitting on a Saturday instead of a Dharma talk. I forget what exactly prompted me to think about this, but something did. Over this long period of conflict, specifically sparked by what's going on in Gaza, but not only in Gaza and Israel. And I was inspired because an affiliated group in New Orleans was having the practice of every Monday morning having what they call a ceasefire sitting, and dedicating the merit of their sitting to what Tia's been talking about, basically. And I was inspired by this, and so I decided to call it the Universal Ceasefire Sitting. And we did that, and the feedback that I got from people who spoke to me about how they felt was good. So we're doing it again, not prompted by any particular thing. But I did get some feedback online, and I'm not sure I've shared this with the Sangha, so I'll just say now, that someone wrote, really questioning me directly for using the word ceasefire because of its political impact right now. Mm-hmm. And so I said, well, that's why I use universal. Mm-hmm. And to explain, I hope, to the Sangha, you know, my purpose here, my hope is that the ceasefire will begin with us internally. That's what this is meant to foster. And I got another message back saying, wonderful, please drop ceasefire. And I declined. I said, I'm claiming this discourse. Thank you for raising the question. So I invite you in 2 weeks to come and sit and make peace with yourself and extend that to everything you do. Yeah. We have a special dedication of the Metta Sutta, we call it, the same one we chanted today, which is a metta practice. So we'll chant that together.
Yeah, I saw that on the board, and I felt, because you had universal in it, for me, I felt, okay, that's okay.
Yeah, it's all conflicts, including right here. Thank you. I think that you had a question, and maybe we should stop after that.
Okay. Yeah, it's not really a question, but first of all, expression of gratitude for your Dharma talk. That was very precious and needed in this time. I just wanted to piggyback on what Jenny mentioned about the social struggle and righteousness, this key idea. I don't want to create any controversy, but I was personally involved in Palestinian and Israeli conflict, and more specifically in defending the right of Palestinians. But the thing that I learned by my practice is that these two camps are just an illusion. We are all human and we hurt each other. So that's at least something that everybody can agree. Second thing about me is that I was born in Morocco and I grew up Muslim. I'm very proud of my heritage. But the thing is that I did some, so my wife is a 5th generation Texan and she loves, you know, doing some ADN stuff, DNA, you know, analysis about the ancestries, okay, whatever. And I did that, and I'm 97% North African, surprise, but there's a part of me that is Italian and a part of me that is Ashkenazi Jew. That was a shock for me. But my point is that this personal journey and this anecdotes just, and I was involved in Muslim and Jewish solidarity and understanding when I was living in New York, but my point is that this personal journey just connects the fact that we're all human and it's just an illusion, the fact that we are enemies. The second question I have for you is that the company you mentioned about the compost, what's the return policy?
Thank you for saying
that. No, thank you.
We're cousins, you know. Mm-hmm. We're cousins. We're fighting. It's an in-family fight.